Welcome to the Arrow Heights podcast, broadcasting from Arrow Heights Baptist Church in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. I'm Ryan Smith.
I am Nathan Copeland.
And I'm Josh White.
We're glad that you've tuned in. We need from the onset to apologize greatly to our tens of listeners for not giving you the heads up that we were taking last week, which was spring break, off. Josh was serving with his group of students with the
Mobile Missions Mobile Network.
Mobile Missions Network.
Yeah.
And we were working with a short week, so we took the week off, and we're back.
That's right. We're back and ready.
Yeah.
Fired up.
Yeah. Very much.
Calm down, Nathan. Yeah. Calm down.
Yeah.
You can I say something exciting that happened though?
Sure.
Yesterday?
Yeah, go for it.
I bought a fountain pen.
Wow.
Fountain pen.
It's a cheapie. You know, if you know Pastor Nathan, I'm not with the technology, you know. But as far as I go is pen and paper. And so I'm writing all the time, sermon stuff or podcast stuff or Sunday school stuff, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so I told my daughter Faith, she was here in town, and I said, I've been dreaming about fountain pens, which I'm a lefty. So, you know, pens can be just a disaster for me. But there's one with a very, very, very fine little, you know, point, and it's
nib.
Yeah, nib. That's it. That's the word.
Nib.
And let me tell you something, there's nothing quite like it. And it's the nerdiest thing I think I've ever done. But I just thought I'd share it here for the world to know.
Is it a quick drying ink?
I don't know.
Have you
it's
used
cheap.
It?
Yeah.
And it works?
It's in my office. Oh, it's great. There's nothing quite like it, you know, because when you write all day, every day, like I do, it's, you know, you got to have a nice pen.
Huh.
And this is just something unlike any other pen I've ever experienced. It's just fantastic. So just,
you know, there
just
are
thought
those
I'd
guys.
Share that. I am excited about my pen. Yo, and yeah. I will never be one of those guys.
I don't know. You're,
but
you're taking a toe dip in the water, bro.
Yeah.
Like you're heading that direction. Next thing you know,
excited.
You'll be like, going for these graphite pencils that you're like, oh, this is like, there are these guys that just, they have their pencils and their pens.
Mm.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well,
congratulations.
The Bic and the fountain pens. It's a serious thing here.
What happened to the number one pencil? Was there ever a number one pencil?
I don't know.
The number two obviously took off.
It did.
I used to have some 2.5 pencils back in the day.
2.5?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think maybe because the number two is required for like, state testing stuff, you know, filling in the bubbles, you had to have a number two. Like they're very specific about it being a number two pencil.
Why?
I don't know if it's is it like a graphite density or like a
yeah,
like
so the machines can read them, you know?
Well, how insufficient would the number one pencil be that you can't even like determine that there's a mark there?
Yeah. My favorite pencils growing up were NBA teams. I had the Rockets and the Lakers and the Bulls, you know. I still have a couple of those. I think I saw the Hawks the other day in my desk. Yeah.
Those were awesome.
Yeah.
Did you ever use the Big Chief pencils?
Big Chief.
That may have just been in Ponca City. No. They were the navy blue, but they were like really big, which was strange because we all had small hands. And so, but it was teaching us, I guess, maybe to grip. And so like we learned to write with Big Chief pencils.
Like, you know, full grip,
grip.
Here's my ex.
So I still write like that. All right, with two hands.
That's why
I had a Big Chief tablet, not unlike what I have here.
Yeah,
today.
When you say Big Chief, I think tablets, not the pencils, but.
Oh, well, they extended their line and it was very popular in Ponca City.
Wow. Good old Ponca.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
We're back.
Well, let's jump into some questions for the day before we get too bantery for this episode. So first question comes from a week ago, back whenever we were talking about Pastor Nathan preached on demon possession, oppression, spiritual darkness. This is from 519, verse 519 says, let me get to it. It says, and he did not, and this is Jesus, speaking to the demoniac, newly healed from demon possession. He says, and he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And so the question to start off with today is, what home and friends could this man have, right? He's living out in the wild, right? In the caves, in the mountains. What kind of friends could this man have? He was living among the tombs and he was so possessed that his chains could not restrain him. So any thoughts on that?
I hung out with some guys like that who were really emo in high school.
Sure, that's so, right.
So yeah, you probably had a couple.
Yeah.
No, my assumption is that he was not always in this state. He did not come from the womb demon possessed, but at some point had been, and so he probably had family and friends before he went down this road and ended up living in the tombs. So that would be my guess. We don't know how long he had been there.
I don't know the answer to the question. how many friends and how, you know, it's a difficult question, I guess, somewhat speculative in a way, but I found this quote in this book that you lent me.
You're welcome.
What's the verb form there? Josh, it's Spurgeon's Sermons. If you've ever read Spurgeon's Sermons, he's called the Prince of Preachers for a reason, all right? And he gets into this thing right toward the end of the sermon where he says, he's kind of just imagining this scene of this man coming back home. And he says, I can imagine how the man's wife would look through the window when she heard his voice. Has he come back in a mad fit? How the children would be filled with terror at the sound of their father's voice until they were assured that there was indeed a change in him. Ah, poor sinner, he says. You have come here tonight. Perhaps you forget that your children often have hide away under the bed when father comes home. I know that there are such persons about, and they may even find their way into the tabernacle. That's where he was preaching. The Lord have mercy upon the drunkard, and turn his cups bottom upwards, and make a new man of him. Then, when he goes home to tell of free grace and dying love, and of the wonderful change that God has wrought in him, he will be a blessing to his family and to all about. It may be, dear friend, that you have to stop here till you have undone some of the mischief of your early life. You have to bring to God some of those whom you tempted and led astray and helped to ruin. So you see, dear friends, there is something better even than being with Christ, and that is working for Christ. So I don't know the answer, but I got a Spurgeon quote for you, which kind of envisions that scene in a pretty moving way, I think. So,
yeah, I think there's a probably a little bit of, I mean, if they see him coming, like, what do you think their first thought was? It's like, oh my gosh, hide, because they probably knew what had become of him.
Right.
But also the joy to see the change, instant change, because definitely acting completely polar opposite than screaming and cutting himself and breaking chains and all that. So yeah, that's cool.
I love there in the passage in Mark 5 where it says he was sitting at Jesus' feet in his right mind. And I may have said something like that in the sermon that just struck me that, you know, we're never more sort of psychologically and emotionally healthy than when we are sitting at Jesus' feet, ready to hear his word, ready to follow him.
Yeah, praise the Lord. Sweet. So, you know, we're talking about the pigs, right? Mm-hmm. The pigs, man. We're not talking about Arkansas.
Okay.
but the pigs, what happened to the demons after the pigs drowned? You know, and I have this vision. It says they went down a steep bank and into the water. I have this envision of them going off a cliff, like flying pigs when pigs fly, kind of a deal.
I have seen pictures of people who have been over to the Sea of Galilee in the area of the Gerasenes and probably even recognize the probable area of where this took place and seen pictures, and it is much more of a cliff that they go off of rather than the hill they run down. There's a lot of sharp, edged,
very, very steep bank. Yeah.
Either way, a very dramatic scene, no doubt.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so, loud. It's just very disquieting scene. Yeah.
Chaotic. So what do you think?
So what happened to the demons?
Yeah, what happened to the demons? Because they were in the pigs when they drowned, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did they drown too?
Well, they are spiritual beings. I don't think the death of the pigs would have been sort of the end of the demons, right? There's another passage, by the way, in Matthew chapter 12 that refers to demons wandering through waterless places. Right, it's that story, that parable that Jesus tells of the demons possessing this man and leaving and kind of wandering about and coming back, even more demons possessing this person. And it's a parable, so I don't know how much, you know, we can necessarily draw from its specific and sort of literal truth about where demons go, but the idea of a desert place, a waterless place, is kind of the idea, I think, of like a place where God's blessing does not dwell, a place where God's spirit is not blessing that particular place. Like, it's a desert. It represents a place just devoid of God's grace and God's blessing. So, you know, where do they go? Ultimately, we know the destination of the demons, you know, that they're going to be cast into the abyss, right? You know, if you read Revelation chapter 20, Satan and his demons are headed for, you know, the bottomless pit, you know, because they've been totally defeated by Christ and by his perfect rule that will come. And the passage that I go to there is Colossians 2:15 that says, "He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him." Right? And the context there is the cross. At the cross, the decisive victory was won. So where do these demons go after the pigs? Well, I'm not sure. I suppose waterless places, but ultimately they're headed for the pit, complete and utter annihilation. Not annihilation in the sense that they're just done away with, but just their power is completely undone as Christ triumphs over them at the final consummation of all things.
Hmm. Presumably, they would still be active today.
Yeah,
somewhere and in some way. I do think it's interesting what the demons make the pigs do. Mm-hmm. You know, they enter the pigs, and the assumption then would be they have control over the pigs, and so it's not that the pigs are so freaked out by being possessed by a demon that they go run off a cliff. No, the demons strategically take this herd of about 2,000 pigs and say, okay, well, we're going to send them all off the cliff. Mm-hmm. So what they're seeking to do is get these people to blame Jesus for, in an agrarian society, 2,000 pigs is a tremendous amount of money, livelihood, whatever the case may be. So we see why the people are upset and concerned, and they want Jesus gone. But that was the goal of the demons, was to go after their wallet, go after the livelihood, in order to make the people turn on Jesus. Mm. Because Jesus had just done something great. But that greatness, what he did for that one person, did not outweigh what he had presumably done, or what resulted from what happened with the pigs.
Yeah. That's good. And just another thought occurs to me about the idea of waterless places, right? If that's symbolic of a place where God's spiritual activity, God's spiritual blessing is not prevalent, I think whenever we put ourselves in the channel of God's grace, the channels of God's blessing, not say waterless, but place where God's blessing is bountiful, right? And the reins of God's blessing and spirit are prevalent. We can have even less reason to fear these demonic forces, you know? If we are at church, if we are in the Word, if we are worshiping with our families, if we are hanging out with other Christians and talking about the things of God, the demons don't really want a part of that. They don't want any part of Jesus and his kingdom. They flee. Mm.
Do you think the reference to waterless places, and I don't know, I'm just speculating here, is referenced not so much that the places they are actually in are dry or waterless, but as water, as in the description of the physical realm? You know, like, unless one is born of water and of spirit, you know, unless one is born physically and spiritually. So in the idea that may they go from the waterless, meaning they go away from the physical place and are in the spiritual realm. I don't know. This is completely speculative and far outside the bounds of what Mark was hoping to communicate.
It could be. That's actually a really interesting insight there, an interesting point to pursue. My thought was, like wandering in the wilderness, wandering kind of in disobedience almost. It's kind of my idea of picking up on the waterless places. I don't know if I read that somewhere or not, but yeah.
But you could be, I mean, bodies are like 70% water, right? And so like between bodies, like between possession, like if their goal is possession, right? They possess the man, they possess the pigs. If they're between, I mean, it could be waterless place between. right?
Fascinating. Yeah,
mine is at least half coffee and half Coke Zero.
Yeah, today for sure. For sure. I'm more water today, but yeah, pizza. Yeah, mostly coffee. Pizza?
That's what I'm made of. Yeah.
No one doubts that one bit. Pizza and tacos, Mr. Copeland. Cool. Moving to the sermon from yesterday, Mark 5, 21 and on, 21, 22,
21 to 43.
21 through 43, yeah. When we talk about Jesus perceiving that power had gone out from him, maybe you can just kind of rehash what you talked about yesterday. Last night in our small group, we just had a discussion on kind of how that played out. And I know there are some dangerous pitfalls that you could dive into if you're not careful with Jesus not knowing but still knowing. And so maybe you could just rehash kind of what you went through in your sermon yesterday on how he knew but didn't know.
Yeah, there are things that we don't know about the exchange, but there are things that we do know theologically about Jesus that we can then take into this scene. And I think the phrase "power went out of him" is probably where we get hung up a lot. You know, like, what does that mean? It seems as though it was involuntary in that regard, or it seems as though it's like Jesus is like electric. You know, these power bullets, like Gandalf or something. He's like shooting through his wand, but
power bullets.
there's like a lot of mixed metaphors there.
Out of his
y'all didn't see the Lord of the Rings where he had power bullets that he shot out of his wand. It was a whole different ball game.
It was actually a rifle.
yes. Yeah.
Sorry. Couldn't not address.
Okay. So back from Gandalf and lightning electric power bullets. Jesus, in his omniscience, he knew when this child was going to die. He knew who Jairus was. He knew everything about the situations that the people that came to him for healing were in. And so I think we have to assume that Jesus knew this woman, knew that she came up and touched his garment. And so when she is healed, in whatever way, that power came from Jesus. And so she was healed by Jesus, and Jesus knew that she was healed. And so when he turns around and says, who touched me? I don't think he's saying like, what just happened? I think he's calling for that person because she probably touched and then, you know, went right back into the crowd, tried to get away as fast as possible because she didn't want to be caught, mm-hmm. because she just made Jesus, this great rabbi, ceremonially unclean. Any rabbi would have been incredibly upset with her. The crowd would have been incredibly upset with her for what she had done. And so I think it's not so much Jesus is saying, who did this? He's saying, whoever did this, come forward. Because there's more here than you just getting healed. So I think that's the case more of it. And it just shows that Jesus is aware of his power, and no power goes out or is restrained other than according to his knowledge and will.
Mm-hmm. And I think the beautiful turn there that you presented so well was it wasn't that she would know the power, is that she would know the person. Mm-hmm. He turned to have, in a sense, have a relationship with her instead of her just accessing the benefits of knowing Christ. It was awesome.
Yeah, because we know some people that seemingly will come to Jesus addicted or in a very difficult situation. And as soon as the addiction is gone or the difficult situation is gone, so are they. Mm. You never see them at the church. So they've come for some form of healing, but they really don't have an interest in following Jesus. Mm. I think that's an example of the situation in which Jesus came to say, it's not just about fixing what's wrong. It's about salvation in and through understanding who I am. Mm. I think that's why Mark adds that I forget exactly how he puts it, but that she said everything. Mm. She let out everything, mm-hmm. you know. And I have a feeling that getting out everything probably took a while. Mm. So there was more of a moment there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says that she fell down before him and told him the whole truth.
The whole truth. Yeah.
Yeah. She spilled the beans.
Yeah. Yeah. The phrase I wrote down that you said, he wanted her to receive not just healing, but the healer. I thought that was a very arresting kind of way to say that. Another example of Jesus doing something for the benefit of others, you know, in terms of him saying, who touched me? Well, he knew who touched him. In his divine nature, he is omniscient. Thank you, omniscient. Yeah, that's right. He knows everything, is what I'm trying to say. But in John 11, I just read this recently where it says, he says, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. He said, I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around that they may believe that you sent me. Mm-hmm. So there are certain things that Jesus does in his human nature, in his actions, that in his divine nature, certainly he understands and knows, but he walks through the process for the benefit of other people so they might understand more about who he is and what he's doing.
Yeah, it's also there in John 11 that Jesus waits and then says, let's go, because Lazarus has fallen asleep.
Right.
And the disciples say, oh, well, if he's asleep, we'll get better, which is kind of a parallel with this passage. He said, no, Lazarus is dead. I mean, he's miles away in Bethany, but he knows what has happened to Lazarus and his physical state. So Jesus has to have that knowledge, and it's very similar in this way in equating death with sleep. So there's a lot in that John 11 passage that is a parallel here.
In verse 15, and for your sake, I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe.
Mm. Yeah.
So that you may believe. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. So down in verse 42, and this came up in our small group last night as well. A question came in also that why does Mark say that she was 12 years old? Specifically, why do they put it in parentheses? No, I'm just kidding. but seriously, like what is the purpose of telling us what her age was?
Well, maybe it may be helpful just for a second, maybe for folks who don't know. I mean, there's no parentheses like that in Greek, right? You said, of course, joking, right? But you know, folks may not realize that it's a way the translators are reading that passage and trying to figure out where the emphasis lies. And so, in English, that's one way where we sort of set something off from the main point of the sentence. For she was 12 years of age. So, yeah, the parentheses are not there in the original, but that's how the translators are translating that to kind of bring out the emphasis of the original.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was telling you guys before this, I actually ran down that rabbit hole a little ways because it's interesting. Immediately you think, okay, 12. Mm-hmm. We had another 12. There's a link here. You know, Mark is tying these together. And where else do we see the number 12? It's like, oh, well, 12 is a very scriptural number, meaning totality and all of God's people. Therefore, the woman who is ill and sick represents all who are ill and sick, and the girl who is dead represents all. And eventually, as I was going down that rabbit hole, it's like there's only so much time here that we can actually address, and that's highly speculative. And so pulled back from that and didn't even address it. In the Greek, there is the word, it says, she began to walk for, and it's this word gar, which, you know, for, she was 12 years old. There's some link between her being 12 and her getting up and walking around. It's not just an interpretive, because that was my initial thought, but it could be as simple as Mark is saying she got up and walked around because she was old enough to walk. It wasn't like she was a baby. Mm. You know, she's a 12-year-old and could get up. It may be that simple. I don't know. It may not be, but probably that's, if you threw something at me, that's where I'd flinch.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there, you know, we talked last night, again, whenever this came up, in our group with our college kids, they, college young adults, they're not all in college. I need to specify, but, you know, when it comes to things being specific in scripture, it helps us envision this in real time. Not exactly as it played out, but knowing how, getting the details specific helps us place it in reality in our minds. So a 12-year-old girl, frames the story differently than a 6-month-old girl or even a year-old girl or even 6 years old or 30 years old. I can visually, I have a visual marker in my mind for what that girl looked like to some degree. And so it just kind of helps seed it in reality, I think, and it's super helpful, especially on an apologetic level. I mean, it's this is a real story about a real kid that was healed, resurrected, and it's phenomenal that Jesus can do this to a 12-year-old.
It's kind of like the pillow. It's another area, and Mark is kind of known for this. Mm-hmm. Just these little details here and there, and being 12 years old in Jewish society first century was very important, because that was around the time that you officially became a woman, officially became a part of the Jewish community. So for a child to die at the age of 12 would have been probably the most gut-wrenching time, right on the verge of entering adulthood.
Yeah, cool. Okay, last one. Looking at 5:43, the very, very last verse of chapter 5, it says, "And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and he told them to give her something to eat." So why would Jesus not want them to tell about what happened to Jairus' daughter?
Yeah, this is something that we encounter a couple of different places throughout the Gospels, and it's often referred to as Jesus's messianic secret. And we ran into this earlier in the text, which is why I didn't go into it, you know, trying to be sensitive with time. And what we said at the time, and we're going to bump into some more of these, and I'll address it more so then, is it appears to be this is more of a pragmatic detail. In that, one thing that we saw previously, when Jesus told one who was healed not to tell anybody, but they went in and told everybody, Jesus then could not go into the city because the crowds were coming. They were so big. It was so overwhelming. So obviously, Jesus wanted this known because it's in the Bible. You know, this wasn't like, hey, no one should ever know about this.
Right.
But this was right now. Don't go tell everybody. Don't go make this a deal. And in some of it, because how much more quickly then would people expedite and be trying to make him king, to put him up? It just kind of, and this is where you get into some other different areas, but messes with the timetable, so to speak. So Jesus didn't want more crowd, didn't want more controversy, didn't want all those things, and that's how we know that Jesus was Baptist. Was the first thing he was concerned about was that she get something to eat.
Amen. Amen. It was probably a potluck, too.
Yeah. Get her some Chick-fil-A.
That's right.
Get some nuggets.
Get them mourners in here to cook.
Yeah. I agree with that. You know, there's a verse in Luke, I'm not sure exactly where it is, where it says, and Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem. And that's kind of like this turning point in the gospel. And other people have talked about the gospels as passion narratives with a pretty lengthy and detailed introduction. Right. So in other words, all of this is just preview for the real point of what's about to happen, and that is Christ on the road to Calvary, right? Dying on the cross to be the propitiation for our sins. That's really what the Gospels are ultimately about. And like you said, to have this excitement and crowds and the point be something other than the cross, Jesus is kind of downplaying that. Except for our passage last week where he says, go home, tell everybody. And I think part of the difference there is he's not, you know, in Jewish, heavily Jewish areas, populated areas. He's in more of a Gentile area. And I think that's really indicative there, that the point of this message of Christ's kingdom is one that is not just for Jews, it's not just for the Jewish people, it is something that's going to go to every tribe, tongue, and people and nation. So to this guy, he says, go home and tell your friends all that the Lord has done for you. So there's a difference there too, in that, yeah, this is where this is headed, and it's not going to cause quite the commotion. Go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. A great, great point.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Well, you got anything else to add? Sweet. Well, hey, we're done for the day. Fantastic. Fellow listeners, we will be back next week. We're not going to skip 2 weeks in a row. So if you've got more questions about pigs, cushions, potlucks after resurrection. You can send those to 918-280-9628, and we will talk to you next time on the Arrow Heights Podcast.